Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, March 10th, 2016. In a spirited debate in Miami last night, Bernie Sanders was exposed as a communist sympathizer. Our podcast opens today with a tune from Reagan Youth. It's called Jesus Was a Communist, Jesus Was a Pacifist. And I was really struck when Univision anchor Maria Elena Salinas opened up a line of questioning to Senator Sanders last night, and she alleged that he had been too sympathetic to Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, and then played a clip from way back when Bernie had a lot of hair, it was about 1981, I think, where he expressed views sympathetic to the society that Castro built in Cuba. The quote was, "You may recall way back in 1961, the U.S. invaded Cuba, and everybody was totally convinced that Castro was the worst guy in the world. All the Cuban people were going to rise up in rebellion against Castro. They forgot that he educated their kids, gave them health care, totally transformed the society." So this was an attempt to paint or smear Bernie Sanders as a communist sympathizer. And it remains to be seen how that resonates in America today. Because in a very strong answer, Sanders said, well, you know, take a look at our history, the history of our relationship with Latin America, and we've operated under the so-called Monroe Doctrine that said the United States had the right to do anything it wanted to do in Latin America. So I actually went to Nicaragua, and I very shortly opposed the Reagan administration's efforts to overthrow that government. And I strongly opposed earlier Henry Kissinger and the effort to overthrow the government of Salvador Allende in Chile. Look, let's look at the facts here. Cuba is, of course, an authoritarian, undemocratic country. And I hope very much, as soon as possible, it becomes a democratic country. But on the other hand, it would be wrong not to state that in Cuba, they've made some very good advances in health care, they're sending doctors all over the world, and they've made some progress in education. Now, he went on to link this to his previously stated resistance to regime change. He went all the way back to the 1950s and the coup that the U.S. orchestrated in Guatemala. Now, I think Sanders effectively parried this line of attack. But my centrist buddies at a political blog called CalBuzz, based here in California, well, they had a field day with this. Headline, Univision is first to make Bernie the Red charge. And in their whole style is snarky and dripping with sarcasm. And I know these guys. Jerry Roberts was the longtime political editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. And his partner, Phil Traunstein, was a longtime editor at the San Jose Mercury News. And they support big money, corporate, centrist Democrats. That's their history and that's their right. But the language they used here, they said, well, an amazing thing happened in last night's debate. For the first time, Democratic voters got a glimpse of the kind of ferocious meat grinder attacks Republicans would use to pulverize the superannuated socialist should his party be so unfortunate as to choose him as its candidate. Now, again, they're entitled to their opinions, but that's an extremely loaded opening. I think you will agree. And so they recite what I just told you about the exchange in the debate last night, and they add that Hillary pounced on it, really exposing her full neocon. She said, I just couldn't disagree more. You know, if the values are that you oppress people, you disappear people, you imprison people, or even kill people for expressing their opinions, for expressing freedom of speech, that's not the kind of revolution of values that I ever want to see anywhere. Well, she was pandering to the anti-Castro sentiment that is still very rich and alive in Miami today, and the crowd roared in favor of that. Now, what I find interesting is at the end of this article at CalBuzz, the authors say, look, we don't necessarily disagree all that much with Bernie's overall analysis. And they cross out a couple of things here. They say, and some of our best past lives' friends are godless commie pinkos. Our point is that while these notions may be fine to fling around the Golden State, folks in Virginia, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, and a handful of other battleground toss-up states may get a whole lot less comfortable with Chairman Bernie's revolution when they start seeing some of the personal political history on which he bases it. Now, I think that Sanders handled it very well. And as I said, I think that he linked it to his opposition to toppling governments. That's a rich part of America's history in the last 50 years. He missed the opportunity to include the military coup in Honduras in 2009 that was supported by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and that has produced the wave of refugees from Honduras and also Guatemala and El Salvador in recent years. So I think it was interesting. I have to say that Univision really bungled the debate, at least for English speakers. They had very weak translations. You couldn't hear the English translation at times. And I have no objection to conducting parts of the debate in Spanish. I'm not, you know, one of those English-only people. It's just on a production basis, they didn't do a very good job of executing. Also, they were very sloppy on timekeeping and routinely gave Clinton more time to answer than Sanders. And it led to further interruptions and some kind of uncomfortable moments for the moderators of the debate trying to get both Clinton and Sanders to stop talking at points. But my sense of it was that they favored Clinton over Sanders. Now, I didn't get to watch the whole debate. I was out and came home while it was underway, and I missed the opening question from Jorge Ramos when he asked Mrs. Clinton if she would withdraw from the campaign if she gets indicted. And she seemed really both surprised and offended by the question and basically just said she wouldn't answer it. She wouldn't dignify it with an answer. So I do give the debate moderators credit for asking tough questions. I also think that their agenda, particularly Salinas in her questioning of Sanders, showed a real bias to the anti-Castro, people who are against Obama's opening with Cuba. And Sanders, as he began an answer, said, "I know that many people here won't agree with me." But he stuck to his positions, and I think he expressed them quite well. Now, Hillary had problems when she was asked about the trustworthiness issue. And this is widely known that in polls, voters who are not supporting Hillary Clinton say that they don't trust her. And she filled up the time in answering her question, but she bobbed and weaved all over the place, and it was clear that she didn't quite know how to reassure us that she really wants to tell the truth. And I think that in that answer, she talked about how, gosh, you know, I'm not a natural as a political candidate, and I kind of have to force myself to do this. Some people thought that was an authentic moment of Hillary dropping her guard. I thought it was a pretty cheap excuse for being rated as untrustworthy. And one of the other exchanges that I thought was interesting is the Univision moderators asked a lot of questions about immigration. And in particular, they pinned both candidates down with commitments not to deport undocumented people in this country who have not committed a crime or who are children. And I give Ramos credit for pressing both people to make explicit statements about that. And in the exchange about immigration, Hillary Clinton made a mocking reference to Donald Trump's big, beautiful wall. She, you know, mimicked him and the way he talks about it. And then she said, you know, that the Republicans keep saying that we can't have complete immigration reform, comprehensive reform, until we seal the borders. And she said, look, the borders are secure. Now, this is something that I think is ripe for political attack. I happen to generally agree with Mrs. Clinton that our borders are generally secure. Now, El Chapo got into San Diego to visit his daughter last November. That's a little embarrassing. But you know, the idea that we can completely seal our southern border, the idea that our immigration problems all originate at the southern border, that is a racist generalization that's not based on the facts. And in recent years, the net migration over the southern border has declined sharply. And the real source of illegal immigration is people who come in at airports and overstay a tourist or other visa. And so, again, I generally support Clinton's assertion that our borders are secure enough. But in this highly partisan and racist atmosphere that's been generated by Trump, I think that is an answer that she will regret. And if she is the nominee, it will be played back for her, or she'll be frequently reminded of it this fall. So a couple of other comments. Bernie Sanders really scored when the issue of Puerto Rico's bankruptcy and the fact that legally Congress will not allow Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy. And Clinton offered sympathetic comments, but Sanders really nailed it when he said, you know, the bonds of Puerto Rico, the $70 billion of their debt, are held by a handful of venture capitalists in New York who bought the bonds for 30 cents on the dollar and are trying to squeeze Puerto Rico in order to make a profit on those bonds. And Sanders was running out of time and had to kind of compress his answer, but he said that these vulture capitalists need to take a haircut on the deal. Also, he got in some good points about the arc of regime change when the question came up about Libya. I'm disappointed that Bernie doesn't pursue the Benghazi issue. Again, I don't think it's the most important one, but Clinton has been all over the map on it, and the moderators tried to pin her down last night, and he just sloughs it off, says he's not going to talk about Benghazi or her emails, he'll just let that process go forward. But he did make the issue about the big picture of regime change in Libya to begin with. And I think that that is something that extends his foreign policy credentials, which, as you know, I have been critical of. And I think he is sharpening his presentation on those issues. Another matter had to do with an assertion by Mrs. Clinton that the Koch brothers are running ads that support Bernie because they think that he's the easier candidate to beat in the fall. And I'm looking at a commentary from Matt Laszlo in The Guardian. He wrote it up this way. Clinton tried to tie Sanders to the Koch brothers because their super PAC recently put out an ad praising the Vermont senator's opposition to the Export-Import Bank. Anyone who's been watching Clinton tack left toward Sanders' progressive populist message would surely recognize they cut the ad to undercut his support and to prop her up. Now, I don't really know the motivation of the Koch brothers. But it's fair to say that Sanders parted company with Democrats and voted with Republicans to kill the Export-Import Bank. And he has a very sound case for it, that it's the bank of Boeing. And again, the moderators called time and cut him off before he got to complete his answer on that. And I'm sorry to see that. She also repeated attack lines that she used in Flint the other night, that Sanders had voted against the bill that paid for the bailout of Detroit. And it's very complicated because there were several bills that were in the hopper at that time, and Sanders explicitly voted against the bailouts for Wall Street. And he wants to be very clear about that. But in procedural votes and on a bill that did not pass, Clinton is claiming that Sanders voted against the Detroit bailout. And as I've said before, I don't think that's a major issue outside of Detroit. And I oppose that bailout more than Sanders did, because I thought it was simply a way to grease the bankruptcy process that was inevitable and allow the car companies to use our capital to shut down plants, lay off workers, hire cheaper non-union labor, you know, outside of Detroit, all of those things. So, overall, I thought it was an interesting debate, and I think that both candidates got their points across pretty well. And related to immigration, Sanders once again, And he has to do this carefully because whenever he separates himself from Obama policy, Hillary accuses him of being personally disloyal to the president. But Sanders made it clear that he does not support the deportation policies of the Obama administration. And a new report out today shows that deportations have actually accelerated in recent months. Jay Johnson, the head of Homeland Security, reported yesterday that they have arrested 336 migrants from Central America for deportation. Since October 1st, a total of 28,800 people apprehended at the border have been sent back to Central America. 128,000 Mexicans were returned to their country. So it is amazing because the Republicans act as if Obama has just been totally absent when it comes to immigration policy. He has deported more people than any president before him. And they never mention that when they talk about their wall and the need to, you know, control the borders and keep out Muslims and all that stuff. And this is a disturbing footnote. Most of the migrants arrested in early January were women and their children. Fewer than half of them, including young children, had been represented by lawyers in the asylum cases in court. And so people whose asylum claims have not been properly evaluated or adjudicated are being shipped back, in some cases risking death or very violent situations. And we're content to talk about a wall. The organization Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, has done an excellent job of monitoring the Washington Post in recent days. And I want to credit Adam Johnson, who wrote this piece that I'll link to in the show file for today's podcast. Headline, Washington Post ran 16 negative stories on Bernie Sanders in 16 hours. Wow. In what has to be some kind of a record, the Washington Post ran 16 negative stories on Sanders in 16 hours between 10 p.m. Sunday, March 6th, and 3:54 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday, March 7th. And there's a whole list of the headlines here. I'll just read a couple to you. Clinton is running for president. Sanders is doing something else. This is huge. Trump, Sanders, both using same catchphrase. Mental health patients to Bernie Sanders, don't compare us to the GOP candidates. Excuse me, I'm talking, Bernie Sanders shuts down Hillary Clinton repeatedly. Now, that is so unfair because I've watched these debates and it's Hillary Clinton who talks over Bernie Sanders, interrupts him, and then her supporters act as if he is at fault for her rudeness. It's just amazing. So this is just another snapshot of how the corporate media is operating in this current campaign. And let me segue from this to NewsBud. Every day I try to mention NewsBud. This is the startup media operation that I am hoping to help launch later this year with Sibel Edmonds, Pepe Escobar, Bill Conroy, and many other fine people. We have a website up at newsbud.com where you can view a 4.5-minute video that explains what we're planning to do. It links to our Kickstarter page where there's a detailed budget of what we'll do if we raise the $950,000 that we've set as our goal. Now, we've made great headway. We have 1,363 contributors, $137,000, but we don't get to collect a dime of it from our generous donors unless we meet the $950,000 goal. So help us change the media in 2016. Log on to newsbud.com, and I appreciate your support. I also like to thank the people who support my podcast here with your subscriptions, the fine folks at DGL Engraving, Casey Condon, Bill Goodacre, Andy Krieger. They're all monthly subscribers here, and I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then you click on the Become a Subscriber tab, and you know the drill. You can take it from there. Increasingly desperate to distinguish themselves from Donald Trump, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio have joined 13 other Republican senators in backing a resolution that is non-binding, but it calls on President Obama to keep Guantanamo open and to send newly arrested or detained individuals to Guantanamo. And they're seizing on this moment where we have picked up a guy named Sulaiman Daoud al-Afari. I mentioned him yesterday. He was a chemical weapons warrior under Saddam Hussein, who is described as the Islamic State's chemical weapons chief. And the Republicans say that he should be sent to Guantanamo and interrogated. They don't explicitly say that he should be tortured or waterboarded, but nods and winks go a long way toward making that point. And this is a conundrum that the Obama administration has created and not properly addressed. They don't have a policy in place about what to do with newly captured alleged terrorist fighters. And the plan with this guy in Iraq, al-Afari, is to interrogate him there and then turn him over to the Iraqis. But the American Republicans want his scalp, and they don't want it on American soil. It's too holy for that. They want to send him to Guantanamo. And this is a cheap shot, but it wouldn't be occurring if Obama had asserted himself earlier and not allowed the Republicans and some Democratic detractors to block him from his efforts to, you know, end the prison there by releasing or shifting the prisoners and closing down the facility in Cuba. So this is a confounding issue. It gives them political gain. They can play on people's fears about Islamic State fighters because, after all, the media and the, well, all of our elected officials, but not excluding the Obama administration, have created this atmosphere of fear. Now to Donald Trump, who, I mean, he gives pathological liars a bad name. And the media, the pundits, the fact checkers can't keep up with the volume of bullshit that's being spewed by Donald Trump. And so you may know that when he wins a primary now, he holds a victory rally and also takes some questions. And the other night, he didn't allow, as far as I know, any questions from actual reporters. He had buddies of his who were in the room at this country club that he owns outside Miami. And so Trump took the stage, and people have compared it to QVC. It's like he was surrounded by products with the Trump name, and there's Trump bottles of wine, there are Trump water bottles, there are some steaks that they claimed were Trump, a Trump magazine, and this is all trying to refute the claims that were made by Mitt Romney last week that when you examine Donald Trump's business record carefully, he's got a lot of failures. But that doesn't bother the Donald. He just went out and lied some more. Let's see if we can listen to a little bit of his bluster.
Mitt Romney got up and made a speech the other day. No, that's okay. Look, no, I understand. No. He's a very nice man. But, you know, I understand. Look, it's hard. When you go through this and then you get to the final gate and you don't get over it, it's a hard thing. I mean, I understand. But he did make some statements, and I brought some things up because he said, water company is gone. I said, it is? I didn't know that. And Mitt got up. And he really shouldn't have done it. It wasn't becoming, honestly. And he talked about the water company. Well, there's the water company. I mean, we sell water, and we have water, and it's a very successful, you know, it's a private little water company, and I supply the water for all my places, and it's good, but it's...
So, there's Trump with his bluster. The water company he refers to is not a company that he owns. They get a company called Village Springs Corporation to put Trump labels on water bottles that they fill. He also talked about Trump wine, which he claims he owns 100%, no mortgage, no debt, and he told reporters to check that out and make sure that his claim is true. Well, it turns out when you go to the Trump Winery website, there is a statement there that it's not owned, managed, or affiliated with Donald J. Trump. It's owned by his son, Eric. Now, you might say, well, what's the difference? Father and son, it's all Trump, right? But he just flatly states this stuff, and it doesn't all add up, and it's not true. So he also waived a copy of Trump Magazine, which he said he recalled reading earlier in the week. It went out of circulation in 2009. Then there is the Trump airline case, which Romney had brought up. And he said he no longer owns it, but he sold it in a phenomenal deal. Now, according to NBC News, Trump Airline defaulted after too much debt and was bought by U.S. Air. And, you know, in some ways, this is an exercise in futility. To try to point out that this guy is so full of shit and just keeps spewing it. Because the people who don't like Trump already know that, and the people who do like Trump and are willing to support him simply don't care. You can tell them anything, and they will only strengthen their misguided support for this idiot. Still, President Obama is hosting Justin Trudeau, the new Prime Minister of Canada, at the White House. There is an official dinner tonight. I'm told it doesn't meet the standard of a state dinner, and I don't really care about that. But Obama and Trudeau announced this morning new commitments to reduce planet warming emissions of methane. They promised that their two countries will play a leadership role internationally in the low-carbon global economy over the coming decades. Obama credits Trudeau for being very helpful in the Paris climate change talks last fall. And so there will be a formal dinner tonight, and they're serving a Canadian, Yukon Gold potato dauphinoise. Oh, gosh, I wish I could have a little sample of that. They're also going to try to resolve some old disputes that the U.S. had with the Harper government that preceded Trudeau in Ottawa. Also, still President Obama has made some interesting comments in a series of interviews with The Atlantic magazine that were published today. And the most notable is that he admits that it was a mistake to topple Gaddafi in Libya. And I am very pleased and a little surprised to hear this. He said his support of the NATO military intervention in Libya had been a mistake, driven in part by his erroneous belief that Britain and France would bear more of the burden of the operation. He defended, I think this is really substantive. And I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to my in-depth interview with Scott Shane of the New York Times. I released it 8 days ago. And in that conversation, Scott Shane details the leadership role that Hillary Clinton played in persuading Obama in what he described as a 51-49 call to authorize the flights with NATO and ultimately the takeout of the Gaddafi government. And for him to describe that as a mistake means that Hillary Clinton's advice to him was a mistake. We'll see how that trickles into the campaign. Now, in the same interviews with The Atlantic, he heaps a lot of criticism on Saudi Arabia. He says that the Saudis need to learn how to share the region with Iran. Both countries are guilty of fueling proxy wars in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. And that is true. What is absent from his comments, at least, and I have not read the entire interview in The Atlantic, I'm reading news accounts from The New York Times, but there is no reference to the state of Israel whatsoever and how it drives our foreign policy blunders. There is no mention of Turkey, which is a wobbly ally, and Turkey is pursuing its own agenda in the wars in Syria and Iraq. And when the president talks about free riders, he apparently is referring to France and Britain, saying that in terms of the Libya operation, that Prime Minister Cameron of Britain became distracted by other issues, and France's Sarkozy wanted to trumpet the flights that he was taking in the air campaign, despite the fact that we had wiped out all of the air defenses. So he also made what I find a kind of unusual reference. He likened the Islamic State to the Joker in the Batman movie The Dark Knight. Obama said the Middle East is like Gotham, a corrupt metropolis controlled by a cartel of thugs. Then the Joker comes in and lights the whole city on fire. ISIL is the Joker, he said. I'm going to have to process that one, frankly. Meanwhile, still Vice President Joe Biden is in Israel and visited Palestine, the West Bank, yesterday. And I can feel uncomfortable for Biden because he's a Zionist. He supports the Israelis and the Netanyahu government. But just after he arrived, there was another stabbing incident in Jaffa, where he was staying. And so he felt compelled to condemn those acts, and then he condemned the failure to condemn those acts by the Palestinians. Now, the Associated Press is saying that the Fatah Party website posted a cartoon on a Twitter account of a hand holding a knife over the map of Israel and the Palestinian territories and calling the Palestinian stabber who killed the American on Tuesday a hero and a martyr. Now, this brings into sharp focus the very different perspectives of the Palestinians and the Israelis. And if you take a very narrow view and just start the clock the other day when this knifing incident occurred, it's really easy to condemn it. But Joe Biden also needs to condemn the policies of the State of Israel that condemn the Palestinians to a second or third-rate life under occupation and under the apartheid laws of the State of Israel. But I'm just daydreaming. That's not going to happen anytime soon. Well, this is remarkable. The United States Senate passed a bill, a progressive bill, by a vote of 94-1 yesterday to address the growing opioid and heroin epidemic in this country. And I kind of compare this to No Child Left Behind, the bad policy of the Bush administration on education that was jammed through back in the first term, and it was severely underfunded. Now, No Child Left Behind had policy problems too, but the lack of funding was one of its major deficits. So these Republicans who are reeling from the opioid and heroin problems in states like New Hampshire and Ohio, they want to be able to say they've done something about it. So they grandstand and they pass this bill, only it's maybe should be called No Junkie Left Behind, because it's underfunded. And so Democrats were trying to negotiate and withhold their support for the main bill until they could get $500 million in extra funding to pay for what the bill authorizes, but the Republicans rejected that. So we have a good program that on the federal level promotes treatment and prevention in the jails, in the community. It expands the availability of naloxone, which reverses heroin overdoses, to law enforcement agencies and makes it available widely. But what good is it if it's not funded? That's how the Republicans operate. An Apple executive named Eddie Q, who's described as the head of services, was interviewed on Univision. And he said that if the FBI wins its case against Apple, forcing Apple to unlock the San Bernardino iPhone, that he thinks it won't be long before the government tries to force Apple to turn on iPhone cameras and microphones to spy on suspects. Now, I believe the government already has the capability to do this. I think that it's in the suite of devices called Stingray. But I can't prove it. I just believe it. And we know of at least one case in Germany where a lawsuit came because people found that some government official or government wonk was able to turn on the camera built into a computer remotely. And Ed Snowden has told us that the government, the U.S. government, does have that capability. And finally today, Ai Weiwei, the Chinese dissident who impressed me so much with his exhibit at Alcatraz just a year ago. He is visiting the Greek-Macedonia border these days, and he deplores what he sees in the way Europe is treating the refugees from the war in Syria. He says these refugees are completely being neglected. Their very basic rights are being neglected. Refugees are not slaves. They have dignity. They are just like you and me. They come from the war, a war caused by many, many politicians for all kinds of reasons. But they are the victims. They come to Europe just for a moment of peace. And he went on to say that politicians use the refugees as bargaining chips. They never really see them as human beings. Their very essential rights are being neglected. It's such a shame. He talked to some refugees, and he said basically they're very naive. They have to escape. They think there's some kind of future waiting for them. From my observation of the European talks, I think they're the ones being left out. There's no conversation to consider them as human beings. Their human rights are being so badly put down. And in closing, he mused, "What happened to our humanity? We are living in such a privileged condition. As an artist, I don't know what to do. I just try to be there, document the situation. We're doing documentary films. We're trying to first study the situation and give the world a full picture of whatever we have seen." Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. Go ahead, put it up on Facebook and share it with all your friends and family. I'll be much obliged. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.